In this final segment for today, we will try to respect the schedule, which includes Vespers at 4:45, so I'll follow my watch, and no later than about 4:40 we'll dismiss so that folks can get up to the chapel for Vespers. Our purpose during this time is to give opportunity for you to ask questions either individually or collectively of the speakers. And I see we already have one anxious questioner.
Well, it was from before. So on your presentation, thank you very much. Let me see if I caught your conclusion correctly, and then I have a question on it. Would you say that we, as particularly in our task as pastors, need to be students of the text, which means includes the philosophy and culture that influenced Paul's catechumens, people of Corinth, and so forth. So we have to be students of not only the biblical text and its background, but then also we need to be students of our own catechumens and the culture and the philosophies that are influencing them and causing them to stumble over perhaps the language of our own preaching, of our own catechesis, the church's liturgy, and so forth. Am I catching you correctly on that?
Yeah, I think so. Did you switch it off?
No. Okay. Yeah, I think basically that's right. I think that I don't know what introduction to the New Testament is used at Concordia, but I know that traditionally what happens is when you have a book saying Introduction to the New Testament, you have a section on the world of the New Testament or whatever at the beginning. Background is called, or something like that. My point is simply this, that in teaching New Testament, there has been a tradition of at least paying lip service to putting the New Testament, placing it in its cultural, political, philosophical context. Now, I think we need to do that better. There is a way to do it better. The function, of course, for us is you're not studying the New Testament simply as an artifact, as ancient literature, but you want to have it have some relevance to our society.
To the preaching.
Mm-hmm. And so it would be surpassing strange to me if a seminary were not concerned about how one communicated the word in the context in which the prospective pastors at the moment, will function. I think one needs to do that in some way.
Well, this leads to the main question that I wanted to ask.
Okay.
Then is what troubles me is that I think we pastors don't we tend to look down upon our parishioners, our catechumens in our preaching and teaching, almost with the idea, what's the matter with you? You don't get this. And is there any evidence in St. Paul where he in his preaching of what we typically call law and gospel, the call to repentance and the proclamation of forgiveness, that he shares in the maladies of his hearers? Do you understand what I'm asking?
What maladies in particular do you have in mind?
Well, that he too has struggled with the same sin with which they are struggling. Or is there any of those kinds of connections that he makes, where there's an identification that that St. Paul makes with his hearers in the task of preaching? So as opposed to Paul being up here, talking down to his hearers.
I think that Paul identifies with his converts, say, in 1 Thessalonians. Chuck talked about the notion of imitation. Now, we must remember that, as he pointed out, that in 1 Thessalonians, Paul writes that letter within a matter of months after these people had become Christian. And Chuck didn't make that point, but I make it simply to lead into one that he did make, and that is that in 1 Thessalonians 1:6, Paul says, "You became imitators of us." So they were already imitators of him. And so he had established that relationship with them, identifying with them. in the letter, Paul uses the word apostle only once to indicate that he had forgone the privileges or the rights of an apostle. The images that he does use, he is orphaned from them. He is their father. He is a nursing mother or a mothering nurse. You see, there are images of identification. He was gentle with them. So the whole thing is the matter of relationships. Though you're all Greek scholars, being good Missouri Synod folk, and you know that if you read the Greek text, he says, you remember what kind of person we were among you, for you, and because of you. Three pronouns smashed together like that. Atrocious Greek. But he does it to indicate that it is a matter of personal relationship, and the relationship that he is concerned with is not the authoritative one, but it is, he works together with them. The language that he uses is that of pathos in the letter. So my point, going back to 1 Thessalonians, it's not only that 1 Thessalonians is what I used to write on, but that this is a wonderful letter because it shows what was important to Paul in the formation of a Christian community and how he related to that personally, not as the authoritative apostle, although he was that, but he's concerned with identifying with them.
Yes, Dr. Justice.
Sorry. Peter, let me just say in Galatians, this identification, I was always struck that right after the list of the fruits of the Spirit, you know, Paul talks about, you know, if we walk in the Spirit, and then he does, don't be, you know, vain, glorious, conceited. I think he's talking about kind of Pharisaical type of behavior. And then at the very beginning of 6 there, I think it's one of the most tender moments for Paul, and I think he's speaking out of his own experience. That if somebody is, you know, a certain person is overcome, you know, in a transgression, I think there may even be an addiction thing, restore them in the spirit of gentleness, you know, taking heed to yourself, lest you too, I mean, he obviously is including himself in that. And that is what, that, I mean, that is, a, at that moment in the letter, it's an extraordinarily pastorally poignant moment in which you can see that Paul has got to be identifying with that very thing and struggling with the same things. You know, on both sides of the equation, because I mean, that's where he just said, "Crucify the, you know, the flesh and the desires."
It seems to me that's very important, but we don't do it enough or understand our office as pastors enough.
I think that's true. Yeah, but I mean, I think there's a great example of Paul fully identifying with them on both sides, flesh and law.
Right. Right.
Would any of you two like to join? Okay. We do have a few written questions as well. Then I'll return to the mic over here after one written question. We'll alternate. And this question is for Dr. Peter Scare. And the question is, how would your presentation regarding symposium be effectively delivered and appreciated within the LCMS?
Well, gee,
I am very anxious to hear this answer, to tell you the truth.
Okay, well, the question was, how can this be effectively transmitted to the LCMS? I thought I just did that, so...
And appreciate it.
Yeah, and I hope you liked it. I don't know. I hope there are some things I don't know that do bear reflection. One is, I think sometimes when I go to church, I have the feeling that from the sermons I hear, I don't know what you can tell what century you happen to be living in, or even what millennium, or because the things seem so. The sermon often seems so disjointed from the world in which we live. So at least here is biblical support for actually talking about things that are happening within the lives of our people. And especially now, it seems to me, as the world's values are changing so quickly, things are put on the TV now that we couldn't even have dreamed about 20, 25 years ago concerning very basic institutions and the very basic building blocks of human life. The values are changing so much that we can't take anything for granted And it seems to me a great part of our task will be actually engaging our people and helping them think out the implications of their faith in Christ. If you have any, I'll take any advice I can on how to do a public relations job on this, but that's good enough for now.
I would give our other speakers an opportunity to respond to the question, or to Dr. Scare.
I'm a member of the LCMS, and I appreciated it very much.
Or at least he's going to colloquize, we understand. Please.
Dr. Scare, perhaps you could film the sequel to Dr. Just's video series on the liturgy as a way to effectively communicate that. My question with regard to your paper is twofold. First, the understanding of the Lord's Supper in the form of a symposia. How does that inform our understanding of the Lord's Supper and closed communion, that aspect of the Lord's Supper and our celebration of it? And then a very practical question, how, short of a Moravian love feast, how can we reintroduce, or this in a very practical way, this understanding of the celebration of the Eucharist and move away towards a more fast food mentality?
I don't think that the supper symposium will have any bearing on open or closed communion. I can't imagine any implications. The one thing I think that, one of the problems I have noticed, and we all notice, is that there is this disconnect between church and Bible study. And at the Bible study usually is the place where we do end up talking about some of the issues which affect our lives. I think sometimes you have an advantage if you actually have the Bible study within the service itself in some way. It seems as if teaching is relegated to a kind of a secondary function of the pastor, while preaching is always given, Lutheran preaching is always giving the high honor. In the Gospels, it seems to me, Jesus does a heck of a lot more teaching than he does preaching. So teaching has got to always occupy our time. And in some ways, I think it'd be nice to actually have the teaching done within the actual service of the Eucharist. I don't know how you could do it. But when I go to mission situations, you go to churches where there's a house church, there's only one room where the church takes place and where the teaching takes place. And it's very helpful. Where I go to church, you have to climb up the stairs to a completely different room, and there's a completely different dynamic. It seems like one could flow better from the other if it were done in the same place. And, I don't know exactly how that would happen, but in some ways we need to bring these two things together and show that the teaching is not something different or something of a higher, or I mean, of a lesser quality or of less importance.
Thank you.
Would any of the other speakers care to address that topic? Okay. You'll wait. Okay. We do have two other written questions, so we'll come to the mic after this. One is for Dr. Just, one is for Dr. Geeshan. It happens that Dr. Just is on top, so I will address his question first. How does Paul's suffering and intense training help us in the LCMS to determine what needs to be in place at our two seminaries, or hypothetically speaking, at future mini-seminaries or training centers for pastors? Dr. Just?
Well, isn't going to seminary an act of suffering in and of itself? I do think, after being here 22 years, my colleagues can probably confirm this, how we see the sacrifices that students give in their families and their lives to come here, and how it affects them in ways that they never would have expected, and sometimes in a bad way. I mean, life itself presents enough suffering. And I think the rigor of our system is good, and I think we should continue it. I think there are obviously going to be ways in this new world in which we're going to kind of deliver seminary education differently, but I think we need to be aware of where we are in the culture and the trends in seminary education. I think our new curriculum, frankly, is, if you just talk to people in seminary education, we're cutting edge on that. I think it's extremely rigorous. You ask the students about their engagement with the text now, and I bet they would say that they're suffering in terms of the amount of Greek and kind of deep reflection upon biblical texts like we've never done before. And I think they love it. I think they're benefiting from it, but they really are working hard. I mean, after the first year, the evaluation of our curriculum was way too much work, very hard, very rigorous. So I think in that sense, we're already out there. I mean, I don't know if this is answering that question, but I have colleagues here who might want to say something about this too.
I would say, at least in my opinion, seminary ought to be 4 years of Lent. And indeed, if it's prayer, meditation, and suffering that make a theologian, we can't do much for their students in prayer and meditation. They kind of have to do that themselves. We can, however, provide the suffering. And we do. We'll have a question from the mic, I believe, over on this side.
Since Dr. Scare told us that the Lord's Supper is also to be seen as a symposium, we can ask the question why, for about a dozen years that I've been coming, we haven't had the Lord's Supper at the Symposia series.
Maybe that has to do with the open and closed communion issue, so I retract my last statement.
Dr. Just is Dean of the Chapel. Do you have a response to that?
Take an earlier flight. We have it on Monday.
Okay, the last of the three written questions, this one is for Dr. Geeshan. As ongoing discussions have taken place by some within the LCMS concerning pastoral formation, how have you placed before the participants the great need to maintain the cruciform of the ministry? Noting that you did not refer to pastoral proficiencies in your paper, but rather highlighted the serving, suffering aspect of the ministry. Dr. Geeshan.
I guess I, just to piggyback on Dr. Just's comment a moment ago, in terms of this whole theme in Paul, as I imitate Christ, one sees that one first has to know and be with Christ in order to live out that life. And certainly part of that, obviously, is the baptismal reality. But another part of that is walking with Jesus and hearing Jesus and seeing him suffering. One of the things our new curriculum does is immediately after a student gets here, they are plunged into the Gospel of Matthew, then the next quarter into Luke and Mark, and in their final year into John, so that there is this immersion into the life of Jesus. And I would say that's a vital part of then learning what this servanthood, this suffering, this cruciform life is all about. It's really communing with Christ as the Gospels bring him to us, and certainly as our baptismal life. Then we understand that this baptismal life in a new and fuller way when we see the life of Jesus and the baptism into which he was baptized, which led to his suffering, his servanthood, his sacrifice. So I think, you know, that's a vital connection in terms of what we try to do at the seminary. And obviously then the pastor lives that out as they continue to nurture their own life and the life of the parish in the preaching of the Gospels.
Would any of the other panelists care to respond to either of these questions? Please, from the mic.
Thank you. Two questions, and they're for two of you doctors, Drs. Just and Dr. Mallerby. My first one concerns R.C. Sproul's book, Consequences of Ideas, where he inverts Weaver's title about ideas have consequences, trying to look at the way in which thinking veered off in the last couple hundred years. There was a quote that you used about the Segal book early on in your presentation that talked about pretty much a modern view which says that there are no metaphysics. And there were some others, I don't remember the exact quotes, but they concern sociology and anthropology. So my question is, Sproul avers that we have to choose between Kant and Thomas Aquinas, and finally it's a choice and there's no escaping it. When we concede with statements like we no longer believe in metaphysics, and when we concede to rather shallow sometimes, and I don't mean the quote you gave, critiques of sociology and anthropology, which are among those pseudosciences which came along in the middle of the 19th century, are we not giving away questions of final truth to the materialists? That's my first question. The second one has to do with the fluid communities, Dr. Mallerby, that you described early on in your discussion. Is there not a danger that we would take into, and I'm not saying you do this or did it or implied it, but is there not a danger when it's almost fashionable to be egalitarian in our era, to take that egalitarian look into that examination of fluid communities and to grant too much importance to the surrounding things or the context and not enough to the Christian voice, because indeed it was the Christian voice that emerged from that meshing as the dominant voice and went on to dominate the world. So those are my questions.
My sense is that you could probably answer your question better than I could. The citation is from Segal, I think, the one where here's what he said: the differing natures of the transformation in our society and in Paul's must be acknowledged. The ancient definition of transformation assumed a metaphysical realm; ours does not. I think that's the citation
that's referring to.
And I mean, if you actually look at what Segal does, and I think this is the problem, is that when you look at how personality is defined then and now, in some ways it's almost easier to see what it means back then than it does to see what it means now. What does personality mean now?
Oh, of course. Yeah, sure.
And if you look at his appendices, I mean, he does really quite a thorough job of looking at kind of a modern... And it's very brief and trenchant on how people look at personality today, and does a little bit of a comparison to the first century. I mean, it seems clear to me that we don't live in the same sort of metaphysical or with the same metaphysical realities that they did in the first century. And so for us to enter that world, it's a huge move for us. And I mean, if in fact we have moved into a kind of a different era, a postmodern era, I think the possibilities for that are greater than they were in the past modern era. Maybe not. I'm not an expert on that, but that's what people tell me. I mean, I certainly will say that I think my children think that way more than we did.
Are we then surrendering the transcendent God for an immanent God?
I hope not. I hope we can claim the biblical God. I mean, I think that's in a sense what we're talking about here when we're talking about the kind of catechesis, liturgy, and preaching that we do, that if it is faithful and an attempt to enter the biblical world and reflect that world in our own church that is, you know, accessible to people, then we don't have to choose one or the other.
And we're not surrendering peremptorily anything.
That's the goal.
Okay.
I would say, yeah.
Thank you.
I'm not clear. In your first question, you talked about fluidity and egalitarian.
I just think that in any kind of social examination nowadays, the presumption is egalitarian. It's just built into the culture anymore. And I don't know whether it's safe to do that when you look at the results, which say, okay, the power of the Christian message and the Christian thesis was what emerged from that. So yes, there had to be you know, peripheral influence. There's no question, and it's unfair to look at something in a vacuum.
Yeah, I'm in a good position that I am too limited in my knowledge. I don't know about social theory at all.
Okay.
All I do really is more social description, a historical description. And now, of course, I may bootleg things in that I'm not conscious of doing, but I'm just looking at the texts, and I don't see that fluidity. Are you referring to my saying that the church in Corinth really had nine of the, half of them outside of Corinth at the time? Is that what you mean by it?
Your assertion that we had to take into consideration the context and that there were these external influences that were, and the community by nature was fluid and moving.
You see, I
think.
Yeah. I wouldn't say influences. I didn't use that word.
Okay.
Because, you see, that it really is something that I would like to go against. When people do the kind of thing, work with the kind of material that I work with, there are different ways in which to describe it. They talk about the background to the New Testament.
Yeah.
Well, the background, many people, is like a stage. You have a curtain against which you act, but the action does not really partake of that. You can talk about the environment, so you look at something in its context.
Understood.
But you can still look at it as something that is kind of separate from the context.
Understood.
Or, I had a course that I taught for many years. I said, the milieu of early Christianity. Well, that's a literary fancy French term. Still the same kind of thing.
Sure.
Now, then you can talk about parallels. Parallel to what Paul does? So what? I wonder if it is not more realistic, and put this in your pipe and smoke it.
Okay. If I don't smoke.
If we were, that's a metaphor.
I know, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Why don't we think about an ecological model? That, in a very simple way, if I look at Webster, when you talk about ecology, you think about the phenomenon in its context, which has its development, and something else that has its development. They share in the same environment, and each develops itself. Sometimes one will work itself out in a different way from the others, with same environment, milieu. So, you know, I don't see that. What I'm really interested in is something that is not static.
Understood.
And Christianity wasn't static. Paul
wasn't
static.
Thank you.
Thank you for your answers. We'll take one more quick question. Hopefully we can move through it quickly and dismiss so that the Dean of Chapel does not punish me with a really bad text next quarter.
Well, this is for the Dean of Chapel. Your description of Paul's theological formation. Have you provided us not only a way of looking at Paul, but also overtones that will allow us to look at the formation of the apostles and perhaps some of the other early converts to the Christian faith?
Yes, I think so. I mean, the apostles may not have had the rigorous training that Paul had as a Pharisee, but I think, they come out of a Jewish milieu, and in a context in which hopefully as faithful you know, Jews, they're hearing the word of God, they're going to the temple, and so they're shaped by that whole Old Testament text and life that they lived in their kind of liturgical rhythms. And so for them it was a natural move, just like it was for Paul. And I think you see in the development of like early liturgy how, I mean, it comes so much out of Jewish forms, and yet they begin to take on their own identity, their own life, in light of the Christ event in the cross and resurrection. So, yeah, I think there is some parallels there. Yeah.
Yeah, on behalf of all of us, I thank the speakers who are here, and remind all of you that we begin again tomorrow morning at 7:45 with the short exegetical papers, followed at 9 o'clock back here for Dr. Wenthe's paper. You are dismissed for the Vespers. God be with you. Enjoy the evening.